Monday, April 8th, 2013, and this is episode 13 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. So first, I'd like to apologize for not having a podcast last week. With the Easter holiday, I just couldn't find the time. And this week's podcast is about 12 hours late because of spring break. Finding a quiet time to record a podcast in my house can be a little challenging. All right, so the first bit of news is about the gigantic internet-crushing distributed denial of service attack that really wasn't. This is relatively old news by now, but I think it's important to cover. Apparently, Spamhaus had pissed off some Eastern European criminals, and they decided to exact revenge against Spamhaus by spinning up a very large distributed denial of service attack, which was allegedly in the neighborhood of 300 gigabits per second. At the time, the media was a bit alight with news about this story, and it was partly spurred by some comments made by Cloudflare, who basically said this was a equivalent of a cyber nuke. I guess there's a subtle distinction between a cyber nuke and a real nuke, or even cyber attack that actually damages things. So a cyber nuke essentially takes down a particular organization for a little while, and other attacks that actually damage organizations and people, those really aren't cyber nukes. So I'm a little irritated by the PR spin on that. There's far more damaging things out there than distributed denial of service attacks, no matter how large they are. We saw lots of reports about how this was disrupting the entire internet, making it slow for everybody, and based on the people I've talked to and the articles I've read, there really was not a perceptible impact unless you were somewhere directly attached to one of the networks that was involved. And realistically, I'm sure this was a big deal for Cloudflare, just not for the rest of the world. The problem I see with this is that it puts too much attention onto a problem that really isn't a significant problem for a lot of organizations. And so now we see management, because of this debacle, focusing very intently on preparing for distributed denial of service attacks. And that makes good sense if your business is sensitive to that kind of thing. But in large measure, a lot of businesses aren't. But even for those that are, distributed denial of service attacks and surviving them really comes down to pre-planning. There's not a lot you can do after the fact and while the attack is happening. You need to do things like contract with your ISP or Prolexic or Akamai or one of those companies who specializes in denial of service mitigation. And also look at how sensitive your organization is as a whole. So for instance, if you are a manufacturing shop and you don't really rely on your website as part of your normal key business activities, it probably wouldn't impact your business beyond somewhat of an inconvenience and maybe a couple of news stories. Your production doesn't stop. However, if you host your website on your internal network and you're being denial serviced and that fills up your internet connection and you do require, let's say, online ordering for parts and whatnot, now your people conceivably can't actually do that because the attack against your website is inhibiting your normal internet communications. So for that reason and a lot of other reasons, I'm a big proponent of separating your internal infrastructure environment from your web environment onto entirely different internet access connections. Not only does it have benefits for denial of service, like I just mentioned, but also for security. We see things like DigiNotar, where the main attack point was their website, and they used that attack point to pivot into the internal network. That becomes a little more challenging if you have such a strong distinction between the two networks. Also, if you host your website at a data center, a colocation facility, or some specialized hosting arrangement, they're going to have a lot more flexibility in handling denial of service attacks. Plus, they'll also naturally have some scalability. So if your business decides to take off, you can grow pretty quickly without having to provision new circuits or upgrade things, which can take some time if you're having to do that to your internet connections to your local facility. Okay, the next story is about a report released by Palo Alto Networks. I thought this was pretty interesting because it gives some statistics about malware and unknown malware and how malware tends to propagate inbound. But there's really two stats that stuck out to me. The first is that 90% of unknown malware comes from web browsing, and that malware takes an average of 20 days for antivirus to catch up with it. And that compares to 2% of unknown malware coming in via email, and that malware takes an average of 5 days for antivirus to catch. Now, the timing shouldn't really be surprising. If you think about it, email-based viruses come in such a manner that you actually have the file. It's easy for you to save it to your desktop, upload to VirusTotal, upload to Symantec or McAfee or whoever. So I suspect if you were to actually look at a cluster plot, you'd probably see quite a lot of submissions early on, and you'd see a number of outliers that weren't submitted, which is really adding to the 5 day number. And to contrast that with web sourced malware, you don't typically have the file, right? That file is pulled down in the background transparently and unbeknownst to you. So to an extent, I'm a little surprised that it's as short as 20 days. For me, the net takeaway though is the distinction between the 90% of malware coming from web sources versus 2% from email. I think this is really indicative of a trend we're seeing using watering hole attacks and compromised web servers. And that again shows the vulnerability of allowing people to have unfettered internet access from systems that are performing sensitive functions or interfacing with sensitive systems or containing sensitive data. At the very least, you need to be using some kind of mitigation like application whitelisting. And this is really highlighting how ineffective antivirus is at protecting against these new unknown malware samples. And by the way, I'm not digging on antivirus vendors here. The problem is that the virus writers are specifically creating their malware in such a manner that it's not detectable. So no matter how good the antivirus companies are going to get, these people who write the malware will take an antivirus copy and run their malware through it and continue to test and change and tweak until it isn't detectable. Okay, this next story I think is very interesting from a legal standpoint, and it is about Choice Escrow suing Bancorp South. Choice Escrow was a customer of Bancorp South who had $440,000 stolen from their account, apparently by some attacker who had malware and access to a PC inside Choice Escrow. So where this goes a little interesting is that Choice Escrow accused Bancorp South, who refused to refund the $440,000, of negligence in not having commercially reasonable security. And what ended up happening is the U.S. federal court judge decided in favor of Bancorp South because Bancorp South offered multi-factor authentication schemes, but Choice Escrow decided not to use those. And since Choice Escrow made that decision, the judge decided that that put the responsibility on Choice Escrow and not on Bancorp South. So two important lessons there. One is, again, systems that are being used to perform sensitive transactions like accessing bank accounts with large amounts of money shouldn't be checking email or browsing the internet other than, obviously, the bank's website. And the other is that if your bank offers multi-factor authentication, you really should take advantage of it. I think you were probably just able to hear our producer, Thor the Cat. Okay, next story. The IEEE has formed a 400 gigabit Ethernet standards body. I thought this was interesting from the perspective of IPS, IDS, and firewalls. We have companies still clamoring to properly address 10 gigabit Ethernet from the perspective of performing deep packet analysis and that sort of thing. And here comes 400 gigabit Ethernet. So if we can rely on previous history, I would expect this 400 gigabit standard to come out sometime around 2017 or 2018. By the way, that got me thinking about a podcast I recently heard. The name of the podcast is Healthy Paranoia, and it's hosted by a lady who calls herself Mrs. Y. The most recent episode, they had interviewed some people associated with the Bro IDS platform. I hadn't really ever heard a lot about Bro, but if you listen to this podcast, it's got a lot of really great detail about the capabilities of this. And if you have any interest in IDS or looking at some new capability to dig into your network, I'd recommend you take a listen to that. Okay, the next story is that AMI apparently had the source code for its BIOS leaked by a customer. The source code, along with some test signing keys, were found sitting in an open FTP server. Hopefully nothing really comes of this, but clearly being able to get a toehold into BIOS would really be a devastating attack. You essentially would have perpetual persistence on a infected system, no matter what someone did, unless they reflashed the BIOS. You know, i.e., even re-imaging the system wouldn't get rid of it. Potentially another problem is, the move to UEFI may be starting to lull people into a false sense of security, and so attacks against BIOS may allow some bypasses so that, the boot record and whatnot can be modified in such a way that malware can load very early on in the boot process. So another situation where a business partner is able to potentially hose up your business because of bad security practices. Okay, next story is about a new ransomware variant that's going around. And as with a lot of these ransomware samples, it purports to be a crime-fighting tool from the Metropolitan Police. So probably mostly aimed at UK people, and accuses the user of the computer of browsing pornography. And in this case, it accuses them of browsing child pornography. But where this one strays a little bit from the ranch is that it actually displays what apparently are at least purported to be images that were viewed or found on the computer. And it actually does apparently depict some child pornography. And this is really concerning for a couple of reasons. Child pornography is about the most heinous thing that our legal systems worldwide deal with. And there's very little room for leeway. My concern here is that people who inadvertently get this piece of malware may at some point end up in the crosshairs of the legal system because they were in possession of child pornography. And one thing to understand about child pornography is if you have child pornography, the charges against you generally are not possession of child pornography, but actually production and distribution of child pornography. It's actually quite interesting the way that works. So I think this particular piece of malware has a high potential of really messing up some people's lives. And so the thing to be aware of there is it needs to be properly addressed, right? We need to make sure people don't panic when they see that. They still need to follow the right processes. There may well be some safe harbor if, as a recipient of this virus, you proactively communicate with law enforcement. But again, I think it's important that organizations figure out how they want to respond to this kind of thing. How do they want their employees to report this if it were to happen? I suspect you don't necessarily want them going straight to the police. You want your normal forensic process engaged. But I do think from a completeness standpoint, you need to make sure that you properly address the issue of the child pornography. And that may very well be going to your local law enforcement agency. If for no other reason that there is a mandatory requirement to report it in almost every jurisdiction that I'm aware of. All right, the final story is some lessons from Trend Micro on the South Korea malware we talked about a couple weeks ago. Their first lesson is that post-PC attacks aren't just about devices. And what this really talks about is that the actual device itself is only now part of the picture. So in this particular case, we saw the malware reaching out to Unix systems that the local PC had some cache credentials for. So you need to think about that in context and make sure that your security plans properly address that. And by the way, to take a slight diversion for a second, if there isn't a better argument for two-factor authentication, I don't know what is. Their next point was auto-updating infrastructure is a viable target. So in this particular case, it's believed that either antivirus update servers or patch management servers were compromised and used to provision the malware to a large number of systems. And that kind of dovetails into their third point, which is that security infrastructure products are targets too. So, you know, both of these point to, you know, two things. One is you need to pay attention to them and keep them updated and make sure you have the right kinds of ACLs, strong passwords, that sort of thing to protect those devices, but also to factor them into your general risk management processes. So anyway, that about wraps up the show. People are starting to wake up. It's going to get pretty noisy in here pretty soon. So I appreciate everyone listening. Again, I encourage you to send me email, info@defensivesecurity.org. Follow me on Twitter @DefensiveSec. The website is www.defensivesecurity.org. With that, I will talk to you again next week. Bye.